Recording. So tonight we're beginning our study of the Noble Eightfold Path. And we're basing our study on this book, The Eightfold Path, which is edited by Jikyo Sheryl Wolfer. And each chapter is a different limb of the path written by a different female Zen Buddhist priest. And I'm going to start tonight by talking about the Four Noble Truths. The fourth noble truth is the Noble Eightfold Path. And I'm basing what I have to say on the introduction to this book, which is by Byakuren Judith Rodger. And because I'm, we're trying to base what we're doing on this book, my talk is really heavily based on that introduction. So it's not so terribly original with me. But I do have my own comments, and there is what I've selected to talk about. This is a very rich chapter, and I've had to leave out a lot. And so I'm hoping that some of you will bring in some of those things that I've left out because they're quite interesting, I think. So the thing that's wonderful to me about the Noble Eightfold Path is that it really is teaching us how to practice Buddhism rather than talk or think about it. Redpine writes that Buddhism is better understood as a skill or an art to be practiced and perfected rather than as information or knowledge to be learned and amassed. And I liked his reference to it being a skill or an art that's practiced. And yet we're following a path with no destination, where no clear signage exists, where the landscape shifts in every moment, and where every step involves examination of intentions, motivations, and possible outcomes. And I think this well describes how some of us feel, particularly when we investigate and find the ground out from underneath our feet. And the Four Noble Truths, even given all that, illustrate the process of freeing ourselves and becoming liberated, which means that we must practice and develop each truth continually, continually, moment to moment. So the first noble truth is that there is suffering in this world. Dukkha is the Pali word. There is a constant stream of dissatisfaction in life. That's how Byakuren puts it. There's the story in here, in that chapter, in which Katagiri Roshi says to her, "You can't escape pain. You can't escape pain." Bhante Gunaratna says, "The Buddha tried to make it very clear that every single thing in life brings suffering for the unenlightened. Every single thing in life brings suffering." There's actually a strand of suffering running through everything. But it's interesting that Bhante Gunaratna adds, "for the unenlightened," because when we can have an enlightened moment, that suffering can drop away. But I'm getting ahead of the story. Reverend Jisho, one of the monks at the Abbey, likes to remind us that this is a noble truth, not a dismal truth. Something I find cheering. So, since pain is inevitable, and that's the thing about pain is inevitable, you can't escape it. Buddhist practice changes the way we view our suffering and this changes our perspective on life. So, first, we have to distinguish suffering from pain, and then look at how we're viewing that suffering. Now, she says something lovely in this chapter about the etymology of the word dukkha, and that is that du means apart from, and ka means space. Isn't that lovely? So dukkha, suffering, dissatisfaction, is seeing ourselves as separated from the whole, as a separate self. And of course, this is the root of all suffering, this delusion that we're a separate, fixed, unchanging self. And it's this perspective that we must change in order to become free from suffering. Dukkha, the word dukkha also refers to a wheel out of kilter, you know, something being slightly off all the time. And it's often translated as dissatisfaction. In fact, that's the word that Bjorkren, her name is hard to pronounce, that's the word that she chooses. And she emphasizes that this dissatisfaction is the suffering that comes from both dissatisfaction and satisfaction. So even in satisfaction, there's this thread of suffering. The underlying sense of dukkha comes from the perpetual desire for our own personal pleasure in life. And boy, do I see that in myself. You know, every moment of my day, I'm calculating how I can make it comfortable and fine and pleasant for myself. It's pathetic, And it's a fantasy that spiritual life can eradicate suffering. There is no escape. It's pretty grim, isn't it? But when we see the truth of anatta, that is the truth of no self, or the truth of the interdependent self, we begin to develop a spiritual stability, as Katagiri Roshi puts it. We find a place that is quiet, connected, and beyond personal identity. So I find that actually rather cheering and something of an antidote to what might sound pretty grim. Now the Buddha defined suffering in this way. He said, birth is suffering, aging is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. Separation from what is pleasing is suffering. Not getting what one wants is suffering. And the five aggregates subject to clinging is suffering. Five aggregates are the components that make up who we are. Subject to clinging. Now, one of the things that Bjorkren, the author, says helps her with this truth of suffering is to think of pain not in terms of her pain, but in terms of the pain. And I think this is important because it can sound like splitting hairs, but when we say the pain instead of my pain, we are taking it out of the realm of being personal to us and making it more universal. And at the same time, I think we have to remember that pain is one thing, and pain is relatively unavoidable, completely unavoidable, but suffering is another thing. Suffering is what we add to the pain and may be well unavoidable. The author also mentions Pema Chodron, quotes her saying, unrequited love is the center of the world. And there's something very powerful about that brief statement. Because we can think of unrequited love as all the ways in which we seek pleasure, seek to get out of suffering, seek to not have to suffer, which don't get satisfied. And even when we get all that we want, we're still not satisfied. Unrequited love. The solution? Stay with your negative emotions and don't turn away from the moment. Stay with your negative emotions. Turn towards them. Face into them. This is our essential practice, both in meditation, formal meditation, and as we live our lives. This is the change in perspective that allows us to shift from suffering to freedom from suffering. It opens the heart. Our heart opens as our perception of suffering shifts. We find a different kind of space. This is a space of an open, non-suffering, peaceful, and timeless place. This is Byakuran now. This refuge has the effect of reducing our suffering. So facing the suffering is to be free of the suffering. When we're willing to experience it fully and really look into it. And there is a strong connection between this radical acceptance of our suffering and the development of compassion. That very act of looking towards our suffering is an act of compassion towards ourself that opens us to all the suffering in the world and allows our hearts, you know, to be in that place of compassion for other beings. We become able to enter the Buddha's heart. Now, the second noble truth, the way that the author states it, is dukkha is caused by our desires, attachments, clinging, or thirsting. We cling to a personal desire system. Now, usually the cause of suffering, you know, is said to be desires, attachments, clinging, or thirsting, but fundamentally it's ignorance. And she talks about that. She talks about ignorance as a darkness which clouds the mind. And ignorance is appropriate here because ignorance is what gives rise to all the afflictions. And really the cause of suffering is all the afflictions or the defilements or the kleshas, all the afflictions of the mind. You know, jealousy, hatred, you name it. Unwholesome states of mind. And the author points out that craving is just an abbreviation for all of this. We say that craving is the cause of suffering, but in fact, craving refers to all the afflictions of the mind. And I think it's easy to see how those afflictions cause suffering. And we can't extinguish our afflictions, but we can practice with them. And that's the point. It is not to think we're ever going to get rid of desire, but from moment to moment to practice with our desire, with the desire that arises in us. Now, I just love, I'm kind of interested in and taken by this notion of a personal desire system, which she says is the cause of suffering. And of course, a personal desire system is based on being a separate self, grasping what it thinks it needs. You know, and every word of that phrase is crucial. Grasping, a separate self, grasping what it thinks it needs. And Byakuran talks about three hungers. This comes from the Buddha. The first one is holding on to sensual pleasures. And she says, including friendships. Isn't that interesting? The second is craving being, that is, wanting to be alive. And, you know, this is hardwired into us. We instinctively fight for our own life. We want to be alive, and there's something in us that makes sure it keeps us alive and causes us to grasp after whatever will keep us alive. And also, the author says, this is wanting to be seen. The third of the three hungers is craving for non-being, the opposite of wanting to be alive, wanting to escape the pain of being alive, craving annihilation, or craving transcendence and attachment to emptiness, which she describes as a Zen sickness. Suicide, not wanting to be seen. So our suicidal ideation, any wish to not exist, falls under this heading. And then she talks about the three poisons. These are all ways she has of getting into what this second noble truth is about. The three poisons, greed, greed, liking. That's the first of the three poisons. Then there's disliking, anger, aversion, hatred. And then there's neutral, ignorance. Ignorance is holding on to an idea of a self, which produces the personal desire system. Living on automatic pilot, being in denial. And she talks about the eight worldly winds: pleasure and pain, gain and loss, success and failure, praise and blame. We want the good sides of those dichotomies, and we want to get rid of the bad sides. And she says, but both sides are Buddha. And because these eight worldly winds are constantly blowing, they call for equanimity. Now, this working with the second noble truth, the cause of suffering, reminds her of the second bodhisattva vow. However innumerable the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. However innumerable the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. So all misfortune is a path of practice. She states the third noble truth as our personal desire system can be stopped or cessated. There is well-being and we can enjoy it. There is liberation. The personal desire system can be released. Now, this is a very unusual way to state the third noble truth. The third noble truth is the great promise of the Buddha. This great promise that there is an end to suffering, and the end to suffering is nirvana, and that this is achievable by all of us. She doesn't mention nirvana in her, in this initial short description of the third noble truth. She uses this interesting word, cessated, for our personal desire system can be stopped or cessated. Third nirvana means to extinguish. So there is, a sense of extinguishing with this truth. And she says there is well-being and we can enjoy it. And I find that very interesting because that's true. And yet, to me, it kind of keeps us plugged into the world or into suffering. Kind of like we're going to find all the things that bring us a sense of well-being and we're going to enjoy them and get rid of all the other things. And that kind of modus operandi is exactly what causes suffering. So so for those reasons, I find it a curious way to put things. But, nirvana means extinction, and the third noble truth is about a cessation of all afflictions. So, in describing this truth, Byakuren talks about a softening of our egocentric desires, our endless chasing after satisfaction, with practice begins to relax. and our natural wholesomeness becomes apparent as the strong sense we have of a separate self begins to unravel. We stop defending that separate self, and compassion grows. The less we're defending ourselves, the more compassion can grow. Katagiri Roshi writes, "Just like everything that exists in the phenomenal world, your suffering is a being," which is an interesting way to put it. "Your suffering is a being that arises from the original nature of existence. It arises from the original nature of existence. And every moment, it returns to its source." Every moment, it returns to its source. So when you see suffering, all you have to do is accept it and offer your body and mind to ultimate existence. Then you and suffering return to emptiness, and there is freedom from suffering. Now, this is really lovely, and it's very deep teaching, and it's also, to me, relatively glib, you know? Like, all you have to do is accept your suffering, offer your body and mind to ultimate existence, and everything's fine. And I don't think it's quite that simple. But I do appreciate that statement of the project, you know? But, and one of the things it points to is that enlightenment and joy happen now, in this moment. That's where the cessation occurs, when we practice letting go of greed, anger, and ignorance. And when we truly understand emptiness, which is a doorway into compassion. You know, we've often talked about how emptiness and compassion are two sides of the same coin, and they arise together. When we open a seed of virtue or a seed of wisdom in each moment, we live in nirvana. The fourth noble truth is the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is the teaching, activity, and process of stopping our attachment to desires which cause our suffering. And this process can bring us freedom. So the Eightfold Path is, on the one hand, a teaching. It's an activity. It's something we do. And all of it together is a process that unfolds our own freedom. And this is where we really get the specifics of how to practice spelled out. And in Zen Buddhism, this very practice is nirvana. You know, Dogen's teaching, training, and enlightenment are one. The Noble Eightfold Path is often divided up into three aspects. And Byakuren talks about these. You know, she calls them the three bases, and they are wisdom, meditation, and ethics or virtue. Sila, ethics; samadhi, meditation; prajna, wisdom. And then, so she's got these three in circles, and in the wisdom circle is right understanding and right intention, the first two steps of the path. Ethics, or virtue, is right speech, right action, and right intention. And meditation, samadhi, is right meditation and right mindfulness. And then there's another path factor, right effort, the sixth path factor, which she puts in the center with those three grouped around it. Because right effort, which is usually grouped with in the right meditation, or in the wisdom aspect of the path, I'm sorry, in the meditation aspect of the path, right effort really applies to every step of the path, right? You have to bring appropriate effort to each step. The thing about those three bases is that they're all essential to a balanced practice. They're all essential as the true source of our release from the bondage of self and our ability to help others in the bodhisattva way of life. And if we leave one of those out, we don't really have a balanced or complete or full Buddhist practice. Might do us some good, but it's not complete. Now, there's some discussion in this chapter of what the word right means. I may be sticking in my own thoughts here. Some authors use the word skillful instead of the word right. Skillful, namely actions which create causes for happiness or for freedom. Wholesome, correct, wise. These are all words that can be used instead of right. But the point is that this word, use of the word right, isn't about right and wrong or good or bad. It actually comes from a root that means uniting or to turn together. The phenomenal world and the source of existence or the universal coming together and working together. I think this is just a really beautiful way of thinking of that word right. And I tried using the word uniting instead of the word right. So we would have uniting intention, uniting understanding, uniting speech, uniting action. I think it puts an interesting twist on how we understand the Eightfold Path. The result of following the path is continuous moment-to-moment practice. And that moment-to-moment practice becomes easier and becomes more continuous as we go on. We find the universal perspective in the particulars of ordinary life, and we are free in each moment. We move from a mind of complaint to a mind of gratitude, and we practice the bodhisattva vows. The bodhisattva vows are, however innumerable beings may be, I vow to save them all. However inexhaustible the passions may be, I vow to transform them all. However limitless the Dharma may be, I vow to comprehend it completely. However infinite the Buddha's truth is, I vow to realize it. Byakuran says, this is the way to end suffering. We don't annihilate our life and its particulars. We train ourselves to hold our life in the largest view possible. And you may remember that we've talked about the fact that when we study one precept, we study them all. I think it's also the case that when you study one limb of the Eightfold Path, you study them. And I will end with that thought. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.